Good morning. This is Wendy Bauer reading to you on December 28th, 2020 from the Decatur Herald and Review. And we'll start on the front page with the article headlined, Shoppers Find Bargains on Post-Holiday Goodies. Stores report brisk business on weekend following Christmas. Donette Beckett writes from Decatur, The holidays may be over, but that hasn't stopped Christmas shoppers. With the holiday landing on a Friday, that left the rest of the weekend for shoppers to snatch up the bargains on holiday items for use next year, even before the Christmas tree was taken down. Now living in Chicago, Miranda Archer, 26, returned to Decatur for a family holiday. She and her grandma took a trip to a local department store on Sunday, knowing they could find at least one holiday bargain. I was looking for tissue paper, Archer's grandma Linda Gross said. I didn't plan on buying anything, Archer said. After finding their way to the holiday section of the store, their shopping cart was beginning to fill with items appropriate for next year. Wrapping paper, gift bags, and the needed tissue paper were easily found. Other items were already gone or in limited supply. Christmas lights, garland, and wreaths were hard to find. There's good stuff, Archer said. Good enough, at least. Caitlin Tillman, 22, and her roommate, Jenna Smith, 24, searched the Christmas aisles of another store on Sunday. We haven't found much but the little things that we needed, Tillman said. The sales are good, so I expect it to be empty. Like many after-Christmas shoppers, they found the holiday areas and shelves of local stores were already barren. There's still named brand candy, Smith said, more than I thought there would be. The two were able to find a couple of ornaments for next year's tree, although that particular selection was sparse. We always need that, Tillman said about her find. The decorations in their home were minimal, according to the ladies. Just because we work a lot, Smith said. With social distancing, this year was celebrated differently for Smith and Tillman and families living far away. Since the holiday decorations were limited and celebrations were distant, they attempted to continue the festivities during their shopping spree. We're not missing out. We're just getting extra stuff and probably didn't need, Tillman said. This is the best deals. Might as well buy it now. Probably yesterday would have been a little bit better, Smith said about the supply. According to many of the employees, stores were busy, filled with shoppers the day after Christmas. Gross and her granddaughter knew to wait for their shopping. I didn't come the day after, Gross said on Sunday. That would have been a madhouse. And next, COVID, the state impact. Weighing when Illinois prisoners should get COVID vaccine. 59 in incarceration have died since March. As a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic spread rapidly through Illinois prisons this fall, 73-year-old Watson Gray made another plea to be released from Dixon Correctional Center, where new infections were rising. Gray had lived behind bars for more than 40 years, serving a life sentence for hiring a relative to kill his business partner in 1978. In the decades that followed, he tried to improve himself in prison, his lawyers said, working as a barber, a teacher, and paralegal. He mentored young men and ran an inmates chapter of the JC's charity, as well as other prison programs. Citing his age and poor health, Gray's lawyer made a final plea for mercy dated November 5th. A day later, Gray died of complications related to COVID-19. Gray is one of at least 59 incarcerated people who have died since March after becoming infected with the new coronavirus in Illinois custody, a death toll that has nearly doubled since November, state data through December 21st shows. One staff member, a 64-year-old nurse near retirement, also died. Advocates for prisoners' rights say the state's delays in broadening staff testing, releasing thousands of medically vulnerable or other nonviolent prisoners, and better enforcing a staff mask mandate have led to widespread infections and more deaths. The latest surge has far exceeded any previous peaks inside the Illinois Department of Corrections since the start of the pandemic. To put the numbers in perspective, there were fewer than 700 known infections of inmates and staff across IDOC from March to early August, when the latest surge began. Since then, the total number of infections has risen by more than 9,000 cases, state data shows. In total, nearly 10,000 inmates and staff have tested positive. "This is absolutely a failure by the state," said Jennifer Sobel, executive director of the Illinois Prison Project. "There is no question that COVID was going to make it into the prisons. The tragedy is the number of people who have become sick and died. That tragedy was preventable." At a recent state Senate committee hearing, acting IDOC Director Rob Jeffries acknowledged the high numbers, which he blamed in part on increasing testing and said mirrors state and national trends. He said the department has responded aggressively to a challenging public health crisis that has yet to yield. Jeffries said the IDOC follows federal and state public health pandemic guidelines, in addition to providing personal protective equipment and cleaning supplies. The department long ago halted in-person visits, imposed a staff mask mandate, and restricted prisoners to their cells, with few exceptions, such as showering. Earlier this month, the state began regularly testing all prison employees, whether or not they have symptoms. The testing is expected to be in place system-wide by late January. Officials also said they are doing more to hold staff accountable if they go unmasked at work. Illinois has granted the early release of about 3,000 incarcerated people since March, according to IDOC data. But a coalition of advocacy groups that sued the state over the issue said the IDOC should free thousands more who are either old, infirm, nonviolent, or near the end of their sentences. And continuing on the front page, Rockford shooting. Suspect charged in deadly shooting. Three killed in apparently random violence at Illinois bowling alley. A U.S. Army Special Forces sergeant based in Florida has been charged in an apparently random shooting at a bowling alley that left three people dead and three wounded, authorities said Sunday. Winnebago County State's Attorney Jay Hanley said Duke Webb, 37, has been charged with three counts of murder and three counts of first-degree attempted murder in the shooting at Don Carter Lanes in Rockford on Saturday evening. While no bowling is currently allowed due to state-imposed coronavirus restrictions, a bar linked to the business was legally open. Webb was taken into custody shortly after the shooting at around 7 p.m., Rockford Police Chief Dan O'Shea said at a news conference Sunday morning. "I am very confident the officers that were on the scene in the building were able to stop further violence," O'Shea said. He said the three who died were all men aged 73, 65, and 69, but did not provide the names. Additionally, he said, a 14-year-old boy was shot in the face and airlifted to a hospital in Madison, Wisconsin, in stable condition, and a 16-year-old girl who was shot in the shoulder was treated at a hospital and released. A 62-year-old man underwent surgery overnight after suffering multiple gunshot wounds and is in critical condition, the chief said. The suspect has no known ties to the victims, O'Shea said. We believe this was a completely random act, and there is no prior meeting or any kind of relationship between the suspect and any of the victims in this case, O'Shea said. He did not provide information on what led up to the shooting. The U.S. Army said Webb is a Special Forces Assistant Operations and Intelligence Sergeant assigned to 3rd Battalion, Special Forces Group Airborne, located at Camp Bull Simons, Eglin Air Force Base, Florida. He joined the Army in 2008 and was on leave Saturday. We are shocked and saddened to learn about this tragic event, and our thoughts and prayers are with the families of those killed and wounded, Colonel John W. Sands, commander of the 7th Special Forces Group, said in a statement. The bowling alley was closed at the time of the shooting, in accordance with restrictions imposed to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, O'Shea said. But a bar upstairs was open. The chief said the upstairs venue has double doors that open to the outside, ensuring the bar is in compliance with Illinois' COVID-19 mitigation guidance. Up to 25 people were at Don Carter Lane's when the shooting happened, but most of them escaped or hid, O'Shea said. He declined to say whether the shootings happened in the bar or elsewhere in the building, saying those details would come out in court. The teens who were wounded were picking up food at the carryout section of the bowling alley, he said. He said the suspect tried to conceal his weapons before his arrest, and that he was apprehended without officers firing a shot. Most of the incident was captured on surveillance video from inside the business, O'Shea said, adding that investigators are studying captured images. O'Shea said investigators are in touch with the Army. He didn't explain why the Florida man was in Illinois. The Army said it will provide full assistance in the police investigation. The Rockford Register Star reported that 2020 has been the deadliest year on record for homicides in the city of about 170,000 residents. 35 people have been killed in the city this year, breaking the previous record of 31 in 1996. As we come to the end of this most difficult year, and we look ahead at this new year upon us, we know that this type of violence needs to stop, Mayor Tom McNamara said. And today, with the eyes of the country upon us, we need to show, as Rockfordians, how we respond to an incident such as this, as one Rockford supporting one another. And finally, from the front page, Trump approves relief bill. Late Sunday signing will continue jobless aid, avert shutdown. President Donald Trump signed a $900 billion pandemic relief package Sunday, ending days of drama over his refusal to accept the bipartisan deal that will deliver long-sought cash to businesses and individuals and avert a federal government shutdown. The massive bill includes $1.4 trillion to fund government agencies through September and contains other end-of-session priorities such as money for cash-starved transit systems and an increase in food stamp benefits. Trump announced the signing in a statement Sunday night that spoke of his frustrations with the COVID-19 relief for including only $600 checks to most Americans instead of the $2,000 that his fellow Republicans rejected. He also complained about what he considered unnecessary spending by the government at large. But Trump's 11th-hour objections created turmoil because lawmakers had thought he was supportive of the bill, which had been negotiated for months with White House input. I will sign the omnibus and COVID package with a strong message that makes clear to Congress that wasteful items need to be removed, Trump said in a statement. While the president insisted he would send Congress a redlined version with items to be removed under the rescission process, those are merely suggestions to Congress. The bill, as signed, would not necessarily be changed. Lawmakers now have breathing room to continue debating whether the relief checks should be as large as the president has demanded. The Democratic-led House supports the larger checks and is set to vote on the issue on Monday, but it's expected to be ignored by the Republican-held Senate, where spending faces opposition. Republicans and Democrats swiftly welcomed Trump's decision to sign the bill into law. The compromise bill is not perfect, but it will do an enormous amount of good for struggling Kentuckians and Americans across the country who need help now, said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. I thank the president for signing this relief into law. Democrats are promising more aid to come once President-elect Joe Biden takes office, but Republicans are signaling a wait-and-see approach. In the face of growing economic hardship, spreading disease, and a looming shutdown, lawmakers on Sunday had urged Trump to sign the legislation immediately, then have Congress follow up with additional aid. Aside from unemployment benefits and relief payments to families, money for vaccine distribution, businesses, cash-starved public transit systems, and more is on the line. Protections against evictions also hung in the balance. What the president is doing right now is unbelievably cruel, said Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont. So many people are hurting. It is really insane. And this president has got to finally do the right thing for the American people and stop worrying about his ego. Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania said he understood that Trump wants to be remembered for advocating for big checks, but the danger is he'll be remembered for chaos and misery and erratic behavior if he allows this to expire. And moving to the local and state page, Decatur Fire Department responds to basement fire. The Decatur Fire Department responded to a residential fire around 2 p.m. Sunday in the 400 block of South 16th Street. Crews arriving on the scene found smoke coming from the structure and a basement fire, according to a statement from the fire department. The department summoned additional fire companies, and the first ladder truck ventilated the structure while the engine company advanced a hose line into the basement to attack the fire. Additional fire crews completed a search and determined all occupants were no longer in the structure. They also secured a water supply line from the closest hydrant. The fire caused minor smoke and fire damage. After the fire was brought under control, an overhaul was completed on the structure, the department said. One occupant was treated and taken to a local hospital for smoke inhalation. No fire department personnel were injured. Decatur Battalion Chief Tim May was in command and completed the investigation. The investigation determined the fire was caused by smoking materials. And next, Trump signs Route 66 Centennial Commission Act. Plans get boost for 100th anniversary of historic road in 2026. The historic Route 66 turns 95 in 2021, but officials say plans for the 100th anniversary of the popular tourist destination received a boost last week when President Donald Trump signed the Route 66 Centennial Commission Act into law. U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican from Taylorville, introduced H.R. 66 in 2017. 2 years later, U.S. Senators Tammy Duckworth, Democrat from Illinois, and James Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, introduced a similar bill in the Senate. It passed and was sent to the House to reconcile language differences. The road ahead thanks everyone who helped introduce and move legislation through Congress to establish the Route 66 Centennial Commission, said Route 66 Road Ahead Partnership Chair Bill Thomas. Their efforts have given Route 66 a very welcomed Christmas present. The mission of the Road Ahead Partnership is to revitalize and sustain Route 66 as a national icon and international destination for the benefit of all Route 66 communities, travelers, and businesses attractions through collaborative partnerships focused on promotion, preservation, research, and education, and economic development. It was established in 2015. Now that it has been signed into law, 15 commissioners will be appointed by the President on the recommendation of the Secretary of Transportation, Senate and House Majority Leaders, and governors of the 8 Route 66 states. Appointees will have demonstrated both a dedication to educating others about the importance of historical figures and events, and a substantial knowledge and appreciation of Route 66, Thomas said. Now our attention turns to making plans that will celebrate the road's 100th anniversary and focus on ways to improve the lives of the 5+ million people living and working along Route 66, he added. We'll do so by working on projects that promote, preserve, and economically develop Route 66. The historic route will mark its 100th anniversary in 2026. The Illinois Route 66 Centennial Commission was created by a new state law January 1st to coordinate planning of centennial celebration events along the Illinois portion of the highway's route from Chicago to St. Louis. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner has noted the historic route that connects Chicago to Los Angeles is an important tourism and economic development resource for the city. A 5-year series of birthday celebration initiatives begins in 2021, culminating in 2026, the road's centennial year. A major part of the initiatives involves developing a visionary fund to support Route 66 through preservation, economic development, promotion, and research and/or education projects. The goal is to position the historic highway, the communities along the road, and the people who live there for success during the next 100 years, Thomas said. Earlier this month, the Route 66 Extraordinary Women Initiative was introduced. The initiative seeks 66 women in each of the 8 states through which the historic highway runs to be recognized as a Route 66 Extraordinary Woman through their gift of $1,000. The gift, which can also be given by men and organizations to honor a woman, can be paid in one lump sum or by giving $200 per year for 5 years. And a photograph accompanying the article shows Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner unveiling Route 66 Experience Hub at the northeast corner of Main and Jefferson Streets on Monday, March 4, 2019. The hub identifies local Route 66 attractions and establishes the location of Bloomington Normal on the historic highway. A partnership among the City of Bloomington, Illinois, Route 66 Scenic Byway, and the Bloomington Normal Area Convention and Visitors Bureau funded the project. And from the local, state, and nation page, feds say suspect died in blast. Officials say deceased appeared to act alone. From Nashville, Tennessee, the man believed to be responsible for the Christmas Day bombing that tore through downtown Nashville blew himself up in the explosion and appears to have acted alone, federal officials said on Sunday. Investigators used DNA and other evidence to link the man, identified as Anthony Quinn Warner, to the mysterious explosion, but said they have not determined a motive. Officials have received hundreds of tips and leads, but have concluded that no one other than Warner is believed to have been involved in the early morning explosion that damaged dozens of buildings and injured three people. Nashville is considered safe, said Metro Nashville Police Chief John Drake. There are no known threats against this city. In publicly identifying the suspect and his fate, officials disclosed a major breakthrough in their investigation, even as they acknowledged the lingering mystery behind the explosion, which took place on a holiday morning well before downtown streets were bustling with activity and was accompanied by a recorded announcement warning anyone nearby that a bomb would soon detonate. Then, for reasons that may never be known, the audio switched to a recording of Petula Clark's 1964 hit, Downtown, shortly before the blast. Investigators have not uncovered a singular motive for the act, nor was it revealed why Warner had selected the particular location for the bombing, which damaged an AT&T building and has continued to wreak havoc on cell phone service and police and hospital communications in several southern states as the company worked to restore service. Authorities said Warner, 63, was not known to law enforcement before the Christmas blast. Warner, who public records show had experience with electronics and alarms, and who had also worked as a computer consultant for a Nashville realtor, had been regarded as a person of interest in the bombing since at least Saturday, when federal and local investigators converged on a home in suburban Nashville linked to him. Federal agents could be seen looking around the property, searching the home and the backyard. A Google Maps image, captured in May 2019, had shown a recreational vehicle similar to the one that exploded, parked in the backyard, but it was not at the property on Saturday, according to an Associated Press reporter at the scene. On Sunday morning, police formally named Warner as being under investigation. Officials said their identification of Warner relied on several key pieces of evidence, including DNA found at the explosion site. Investigators had previously revealed that human remains had been found in the vicinity. In addition, investigators from the Tennessee Highway Patrol recovered parts from the RV among the wreckage from the blast and were able to link the vehicle identification number to an RV that was registered to Warner, officials said. We're still following leads, but right now there is no indication that any other persons were involved, said Douglas Korneski, special agent in charge of the FBI's Memphis field office. We've reviewed hours of security video surrounding the recreation vehicle. We saw no other people involved. Police were responding to a report of shots fired Friday when they encountered the RV blaring a recorded warning that a bomb would detonate in 15 minutes. Suddenly, the warning stopped and Clark's hit, Downtown, started playing. The RV exploded shortly afterwards, sending black smoke and flames billowing from the heart of downtown Nashville's tourist scene, an area packed with honky-tonks, restaurants, and shops. And this will end our first half-hour reading from the Decatur Herald and Review for December 28th, 2020. We will take a short break and return with the second half-hour. We hope you'll stay tuned.